From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home nutrition from my home, at least. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is known for so much, including as a pretty interesting author, and his newest project is a book. It is Chasing the Light, and he's done, I think, probably one of the most adult adaptations of somebody you might think of as a Marvel Comics hero or character, and that character is described in the introduction as being black-haired, sullen-eyed, with gigantic mirths and gigantic melancholies, and that certainly could apply to my guest, Oliver Stone. Oliver, it's good to talk to you. How are you?
Thank you, Elvis. I'm okay. I'm laughing at your reference to Conan the Barbarian.
It strikes me as being, in some ways, quintessentially you, although you speak a number of times in the book about Tennyson's poem Ulysses, and I also think about a line from that poem that could define what you do, which the I think it's the thunder and the sunshine. And I guess in reading the book, and you detail so much of your time on the early projects and your early life, I was just thinking that your early films as a director, certainly Platoon and Salvador and even Wall Street, feel like journal entries. So it's so interesting to see that you were a journal keeper as a young person.
Yeah, my father encouraged me to write for money early when I was about seven. He'd give me a quarter, 25 cents a week to turn in a theme on Saturday. And I didn't particularly care for writing, but I enjoyed making the money and getting a comic book and or something else. And in those days, it was 1950s, a classic comic I could get for 15 cents. So I had 10 more cents left. And I enjoyed, I also could buy a Donald Duck comic for 10 cents. So, you know, it added up. I had a great comic book collection. After a while, I wrote a lot of themes. And in other words, he encouraged me to use my imagination. When I was a little bit older, we'd go to the movies together. He took me to good movies. My mother took me to the crappy movies. My mother loved movies, but took me to a lot of the B features. My father would take me to good movies, and we'd come out of the movie, and he'd always, and invariably, no matter what, Bridge on the River Kwai or On the Waterfront, he'd say, good movie, but, and then there was always a but, and he'd say, do you remember that scene and blah, blah, blah? And he'd say, there was a hole in the movie, in the logic. It didn't make sense. And then as a result, another thing didn't make sense. As a result, that didn't make sense. So he would always link things rationally, which, of course, is very difficult when you come to movies. And I would argue with him a bit. And at the end of it, he'd say, well, you know, you and I could have done it better, kiddo. Always that. So I think that was early encouragement somehow for screenwriting. He was a logical man.
I was sort of struck by that journal keeping, just because, again, those early movies feel like, a lot of them have the writing that feels like journal entries to me. And I wonder if that was something, I would say that Boyle in Salvador is basically the way the movie unfolds, as if it's coming out of his journal. I mean, it has that kind of immediacy of journal entries. Think about when he's in a hallway on the phone, or that scene you write about early in the book with the horses thundering past woods and John Savage. Yeah. I mean, that has the immediacy of something somebody would run home and write down to me almost.
No, that's not quite the case in this, but I appreciate it. But I'm glad the movies had immediacy. But no, the diary writing was more intermittent back then. And but then it became more present in my life after the 1980 period, 81, 82. And I kept a pretty thick diary. I mean, it's got thousands of pages now. So I'm quite ready for, I got a lot of ammunition for a second book. But journal writing was very important to developing a style. But Salvador was definitely about a journalist. That was for sure. It was never intended as a journal entry because Richard Boyle was much too chaotic to keep a diary.
No, I guess I was struck by that too, the idea of trying to make sense out of chaos, which is also what's happening, and to a great extent in Platoon and in Midnight Express, I think, too, these characters trying to make sense out of chaos.
You could say that. You could definitely say that they were nightmare situations. A Salvadoran civil war is quite, it wasn't well reported on. It was kind of a hidden horror show that was going on for years. with Boyle made me aware of it. And I think I wanted to bring it to Americans' attention. It's interesting. The Americans were not interested in Salvadors in our backyard, very rarely interested. Public is very rarely interested in affairs of Central America or South America. But Salvador was a real, for me, a big start, a big foothold into the movie business. It was my third directed film and my first big film. Nobody supported it. Nobody wanted to do it. It was made, every American distributor turned it down, even when it was shot and finished. It was made by an Englishman, an independent Englishman, John Hemdale. They financed it and they distributed the film. It was an amazing story in 1986.
And you had that double punch of having these movies Oscar nominated simultaneously.
That was sort of my beginning. I mean, I had gotten into the business as a writer, screenwriter with Midnight Express in 78-79, and was very well. It was like powerfully received, went around the world, also a low budget film. The director, Alan Parker, who just passed away yesterday or 2 days ago, was his first major movie. As I say, it really swept the world and got me an Oscar. And of course, there was a lot of issues behind it. I talk about those issues in the book, what was going on. It was an amazing story because Billy Hayes lied to us. Billy Hayes is the character who we wrote about, and he didn't tell us the whole truth when we first interviewed him. But anyway, that led to a plateau, and that was my introduction to the movie business. And 1979 was, as I wrote, a golden year for me in all ways. But then there was a reversal of fortune, and I talk about having to start completely over from the bottom again after I made, I wrote the scripts for Scarface and Year of the Dragon, 8 Million Ways to Die, but none of them did me much good in terms of the career. And I also directed and wrote The Hand with Michael Caine in a horror film. And that was a reversal of fortune too. So I was up and down a few times in this business.
Yeah, but it's funny because I guess I just think about how in the early parts of the book, and I just want to talk to you about a little bit, I guess, themes in your work. So often in these things that you've written, I mean, your scripts, there is somebody who's faced with kind of an institutional truth and having to ask questions about that and sort of coming to terms with what the real world is. I mean, there's an institutional truth that is bucked against in Wall Street, and even in Scarface, certainly in Platoon and in Salvador, a lot of that sort of questioning of institutions and kind of an institutional lie seems to come from your own life, doesn't it?
Yeah. No, I've been, you could say I'm a rebel against it or anti-authoritarian, whatever you want, but I certainly took the side of the underdog in most of these scripts. And certainly in my directing life, too, it was a struggle, a struggle of a rebel, really. I mean, I didn't set out to be. I was a very conventional boy in school. I wanted to get along, do good, do the right thing, so to speak. And then I talk about the power, the effect of my parents' divorce on me when I was 15 years old. And that kind of shattered the whole illusion of what my life would be. And I had to rediscover for myself alone. I had no brothers or sisters. I had to rediscover what a family meant. There was a lack of truth in their marriage. I call the child of divorce, in the sense that what do we believe? We don't really know what the reality is. I began to doubt what reality was. I thought that reality after the divorce was loneliness, and I thought there was happiness and was very difficult to achieve. And I went through hell, in other words. I felt that there was a lot of similarities to Catcher in the Rye. I don't know if you read it, but it was a powerful book back in those days. And I felt very close to that character and quit school, basically ran away from school, and then quit college. Went to Vietnam as a teacher, and then I joined the Merchant Marine as a wiper, and traveled around Asia, came back to the U.S., wrote a book, my first book. Didn't get published, and I pulled out of Yale University a second time for the good, and I volunteered for the draft and went to Vietnam as an infantry soldier. So I was breaking entirely with my past, my parents, everything I had known that was civilized on the East Coast. It was quite a change, and I went out into the world to discover it the way it is. learned a lot.
No, I was asking that because in reading the book and that you talk about in that chapter, we find out that your parents are separating and it was traumatic right down to the way you were being summoned to your dean's office. And that was something that never happened. And it was this break. And again, that felt to me like the moment where, especially the age at which that happened to you and in that time where that kind of information was kept away from kids and it wasn't even talked about much in the culture, to have that basically that kind of rock thrown through the window of your life really does make you question what these truths are. And you were talking about your first novel. I remember reading in that book, A Child's Night Dream, there's a line that almost recurs, "What am I looking for?" Which really seems to be the life you're writing about in your book, Chasing the Light, too, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's why I wrote the book. I mean, what is the meaning of my life? I think it's a key question for everybody to answer. Why are we doing what we do? And certainly, I would never have done what I did unless my window had been shattered, as you say. The rock was thrown through the window. I didn't see it coming. I had a sheltered and privileged life before that. And all of a sudden, on top of that, not only does my father call me on the phone and tell me this, and I don't see my mother, she disappears to Europe because she's French, and she was in a very bad way because there was quite a bit of turmoil in their divorce. In those days, it was, you had to prove, there was adultery, she had a lover, he had lovers. It was a devastating. I thought they were in love. I thought it was a happy family. All of a sudden it fell apart on one day. In less than 15 minutes, I was told all this. And no one was going to come and visit me from my home, nor for that matter would the headmaster release me to go home for a few days because I'd get so behind in the schoolwork. It was tough. Although the divorce rate was growing in New York City, and it became pretty standard in the city social life that I knew, at that time it was still rare, and the kids were stigmatized by divorce.
And reading that section of the book, it reminded me of so many moments in your movies that you're building towards tension, and the character is walking into a room and the unexpected happens to him. It's funny how that moment, as you especially, you write about it so well in the book, you could really feel that pressure and could feel, you almost feel your skin tingling as you walk into trying to figure out if you should go see the headmaster and what could this possibly be, because this kind of thing had never happened to you.
Yeah.
And you did have this idyllic life, almost not that dissimilar to the way Ron Kovic wrote about his life in the first third of his book.
Yes, I agree. On top of that, there was a second shock. I talk about when I finally catch up with my father 2-3 weeks later and on spring break. And he tells me then that he's broke. My mother had way overspent. That was my mother's way. It was her style. She was bigger than life, sort of a young Annie Mame, if you will. And my father was keeping up pretenses and keeping up the New York City lifestyle, so to speak, for business reasons and so forth. But he was dead broke. He was not only dead broke, he was in debt. And that was a shock. In fact, he stayed in debt for almost 20 years after that. He never got out of that debt because that debt in those days was, I guess, it was $100,000 in debt. And although he made a good living and I did get the rest of my education, or I didn't, but I almost did. I mean, he was offering it. It was just never the same. He moved into a small apartment in a hotel and she moved to Paris and she came to the States eventually back to a small apartment. So it was a different lifestyle and everything changed.
It's such a interestingly personally rendered piece of writing, and watching your life be upended like that. I mean, and I did find myself in reading that. I almost went back and dug out, certainly watched again, Born on the 4th of July, because I thought so much about what eventually must have connected you to Ron Kovic, which you talk about at some length in the book, but your life being different than his. But still, you both were kind of swaddled in this the American dream that was available to anybody in the 1950s.
Yeah, except I went with Ron's story instead of my own because I thought mine was still out of reach for most people. It was not the average life. It was very exotic in the sense of it was around New York. And whereas Ron was much more all-American, having grown up in a smaller town, Massapequa, Long Island. His father was an A&P grocery clerk and Polish roots. That's why I went with Ron's story over mine on the return to America.
Well, we're going to take a break. My guest is Oliver Stone. His memoir is Chasing the Light. We'll get into what that's all about when we return to Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is Oliver Stone. He's back to join us for his, I guess, first in a series of books from the way he's talking, Chasing the Light, which is about the beginnings of his life. And you mentioned your comic collection. As you know, that's kind of an interest of mine. And this may be the only major autobiography by a director who mentions one of my favorite people, Barry Windsor Smith. And and, you know, that scene that you describe in the opening of the book, which is, again, with the horses thundering through the plaza in Salvador, could have been a scene out of one of Barry Windsor Smith's illustrations for Conan the Barbarian. And your story about what you wanted that to be, and I, based on that, I still want to read that script and see that movie. And what it became, I was really fascinated by.
I loved Conan. Ed Pressman brought me, he had the rights. And I set out to write the most sumptuous big script, you know, homage to Robert Howard, who'd written, I don't know, 12 pulp novels about Conan, as well as many other characters. But he had, it was so imaginative. It was, as I compared it in the book, I said it was a Tarzan series. It could have been the most successful series ever, like a James Bond series. One adventure after another, exotic people, exotic characters, beautiful women. It was so young male, so to speak. And Conan, as you say, looked like Jim Morrison. He was a rock star at the same, he was a free man. That was the whole point. He was a free man. He wasn't Tarzan. Tarzan was a moral Victorian character, very Burroughs, Edgar Rice Burroughs, whereas Howard was more pulp, he was amoral. I mean, it was Conan certainly could be a thief and a murderer and all that, but at the same time, he had a basic goodness. He would only kill the bad people, including he'd kill everybody, anybody. I mean, who screwed him over? He would kill women as well as monsters. And the movie, if it had been successful, which I think it could have been, and I wanted to direct it, but I didn't have the skills at that point. I wanted Ridley Scott to do it. He just did Duelists, and he was doing Alien, and no one had seen it yet. But Ridley was working on Blade Runner and couldn't do it. Which broke my heart because I really wrote the script with him in mind. And then John Milius and Dino De Laurentiis got a hold of it from Ed, and that was the end of it because they never collaborated with us. They just promised to collaborate, but they never did. And they turned it into in my mind, a cheaper version, a Dino De Laurentiis kind of version of a Western with fake cactus and all. I don't know. It was just another weird kind of... The point is that Dino and it was very successful in the sense that it introduced Arnold Schwarzenegger, which was great as Conan, and it was moderately good film. But the second film was, again, cheaply made by another director, and it was badly made, and it died after two films. It could have been a 12 film series, and it was right. This was before Lord of the Rings and after Star Wars, but I definitely felt strongly that it was a big setback for me. I really believed in the film, and it wasn't what I intended to do. But the free man concept always is, I wanted to go back to it in my work and always admired that kind of figure, which is why I did the Jim Morrison movie pretty early in my career. I was paying homage to that kind of persona.
I think you're paying homage to that kind of persona too with Gordon Gekko. I mean, there are so many of those figures these guys who you can even say to some extent Barnes in Platoon, I mean to say, these guys who really are in one way or another in tune with the kind of the wilder winds of nature who are kind of impervious to conventional morality. And when you, again, just seeing the mention of Barry Windsor Smith first of all, I was tickled by that. But I also thought too, that often your action scenes have that kind of feel of that beautifully choreographed sprawl of Barry Smith's.
Yeah.
And I was really impressed by that.
You know, I worked with Barry I liked him so much. He was the second illustrator on the comics, maybe this third. I don't know. There was other. Frazetta, I think, started. I'm not sure exactly who started the book.
Frazetta did the covers for those paperbacks for the comics. Actually, Barry Smith was the first.
Oh, he was. Well, Barry, I idolized him, and I called him up when I did The Hand, because The Hand, if you remember, with Michael Caine, was about a cartoonist.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
An illustrator who's drawing a character called Mandro, and he loses his hand in a car accident with his wife is driving, and he's very paranoid that she's younger than he is and sexy, and she's leaving him. That's his fear. And he's haunted by the idea that he has a phantom limb. This phantom hand has come back, and expressive of his anger, unknown, unconscious anger, kills people who get in his way, including the illustrator who replaces him. So all the so Barry drew all the boards in the film, and they're very quite good. And Michael Caine is hilarious talking about his character when he says, "That's not Mandro," to his replacement, because the replacement character is thinking more self-conscious. He's more like the modern comic world of self-consciousness, whereas Michael Caine's character is not self-conscious, doesn't want to be, denies it. And he says, "Mandro is not that." He says, "No. Mandro's a winner," you know, kind of thing. And it really plays as a theme through the movie. But Barry was great, very modest man, very elegant drawings too.
I was thinking about how that power of what you know, Robert E. Howard wrote. And again, as I said in the introduction, you know, because he was later, we found out that he was a bipolar, gigantic melancholies and gigantic mirth. And that kind of spirit, of that almost elemental spirit, is something that really, I think, the movies of yours, with that real power, even something like U-Turn, somebody who basically has his feet firmly planted on the ground and is not in one way or another part of conventional morality.
That's true.
Those kind of characters we're talking about, that sort of one character who's kind of rooted, or a character who's rooted in wanting to be liked,
yeah,
or wanting to be understood by people, and someone else who
absolutely
is kind of an amanuensis who recognizes both the joy and the responsibility of freedom. I mean, that basically you have to watch your back all the time.
Conan is a free man, yeah. And he's a great character. He was... The memoir runs, you know, I felt like it ended after the first 40 years. And I say that in the foreword. I said, it is about a young filmmaker growing into a filmmaker and realizing his dream. And I clarify it as one dream, the dream being to make this movie about his experience in Vietnam, so to speak, in platoon. And that experience is the determinant in the book. It drives the book because he can't get platoon made. And it's the truth about Vietnam as he knows it. But no one wants to listen to the truth, whereas they're making films like Sylvester Stallone's Going Back to Vietnam to save the POWs, and Chuck Norris's Missing in Action series that are making a fortune. But no one wants to make Platoon. And then Apocalypse Now, Deer Hunter are great films, mythic films, but they're nothing to do with the reality on the ground that I saw. So it's very frustrating. I mean, and when I write Midnight Express, I put some of that ferocity, that authenticity I knew of savagery into it, and it was misunderstood in a big way, and it hurt me. Scarface is the same thing. There is an authentic character there, a very, very free character. Tony Montana is a free man, and he hates the system. He criticizes, he calls it hypocritical. And he goes down in the end, but at least he goes down the way on his terms. And so I mean, I'm working to get it out of me, but it doesn't get out. It doesn't quite work with Mickey Rourke in Year of the Dragon. And I talk about why. I talk about the differences between the directors and the actors, Pacino and Rourke. But I think when I finally got to Salvador, it comes out. You find a real character in Jimmy Woods that I can breathe. That's not me. That's not me. And that's where the critics often get me wrong. I mean, I think Pauline Kael said, "I was Richard Boyle." That's not true. He was Richard Boyle, though, or a version of Richard Boyle, because Richard Boyle was a different kind of character than I was. He was a man who was really living day to day on his wits, and lying, immoral, amoral, whatever you want to call it, get anything to get a story, anything to continue. And Jimmy brought it to life. But at the same time, it was very difficult for me to get that performance and for him to live up. That movie was made under the most difficult circumstances any movie's ever been made. I think we had half the budget. We had 92 speaking parts, two countries, tanks, horse charges, all kinds of airplanes, helicopters, Civil War. It was just an enormous project, and we had no money. And it was just my desire to make it, my desire to finally express myself, to find the light. And my God, what a story. It's amazing that it got made, and then it came out. Nobody wanted to distribute it except for John Daly's company. They did a legitimate job, but you know, it wasn't going anywhere until actually it had a second wind when a few critics talked about it finally, and they had some very good reviews. And finally, the Platoon came out. Platoon is maybe the Barnes character is a part of me. Certainly Elias character, the Willem Dafoe character is a part of me too. And also the Charlie Sheen character. That's me more or less, as watching both antagonists and protagonists against each other, watching the civil war that I saw inside every combat platoon I was in Vietnam. There was this difference between people. There was what I call the law and order set and the rebel set. The law and order set that with the Barnes people were more racist, definitely against the Vietnamese. So I sided with the Elias people, who I felt were represented. They were keeping alive their souls. They were freer people. And among them, I hung out with, for the first time in my life, I hung out with the black soldiers. I don't know why, but they were the ones I preferred. They were smoking dope. Their music was great. They were funny. They were keeping their humanity alive in a very difficult situation where most people were coarsening, getting uglier. You know what I'm saying? I finally got there. And that's why the book has to end, because it's going to go. There's so many other films coming. But this is the end of the story. The first 40 years of my life. It ties into my youth and growing up and being deceived, looking for a light of freedom. Of course, chasing the light means you're trying to get the last shot of the day. You understand what I'm saying? It's about getting the last shot of the day, because often you would do your best work at the end of the day.
But it's also, as you're saying, it's about chasing that spiritual light you're talking about, that difference between sort of conventionality and opening yourself up to experience and about freedom. And I can't believe this. We're out of time. You got to come back, make another movie, write another book, something. It's always so great to talk to you, Oliver. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Elvis. I appreciate you having me.
Our guest, of course, is Oliver Stone. His book, of which, again, there's many to come. There'll be 12, like Conan the Barbarian. His book is Chasing the Light. Our recording engineer at KCRW, who also mixes the show, is Kat Yor. It's edited by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everybody. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.